Welcome to the Clement Stand with the Final Stand, Professor. Today we have Professor Tatiana Koshekova with us. She is a professor, associate professor at General Global Law School, and the author of several books and a series of articles on applied ethics and the philosophy of man and technology. Her focus area is the new vision of the human being as a result of technological convergence. She holds two PhDs, one of self in speech arts theory and the second in philosophical anthropology titled Valdemar Solovar's Theory on Humanity. She has made her mark as a postdoctoral associate in environmental philosophy at for humanity and later as a lecturer in applied ethics and philosophy of technology. She published a book, The Plurality of the Arts of Living, with Rico Sneller, and is now finalizing the draft of Homo sapiens as a problem. Her commitment to the environmental discourse is illustrated through the two electives she currently teaches. The first one is Environmental Humanities and Climate Emergency, which focuses on climate change as a manifestation of the social, economic, and political dynamic of global civilization. The second one is Climate Crisis and Sustainability, a scientific and planetary view, which teaches the next generation how to deal effectively with the challenges of climate change and build resilience to its challenges. So today she's here with us to talk about geopolitics and geoengineering. Do they threaten climate change mitigation and its broader implications today and for the future? Thank you so much for being here, Professor. So let's dive right in. What is geoengineering?
Good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for inviting me for the podcast. Great to meet you. So what is geoengineering? Geoengineering is basically a technological modification of climate. Climate on the Earth is a self-regulating system, as the climate is being regulated by the planetary biosphere by itself. It has been like this for centuries, even though it fluctuates, it changes. We had ice ages, we had hot periods, but it was only in the recent couple of centuries when human beings become a dominant force on the Earth and started determining the climate. So we have already changed climate unwillingly, unplanned. It was like accident. Nobody wanted to do it, but we already forced too much CO2, carbon dioxide, into the air. As a result, we caused global warming, and the scientists have found that we caused global warming only after it was already in the course. So we already hit it in the last two centuries. The temperature, global temperature, already rose by 1 degree Celsius. This is already happening, and the point was it was discussion in US, especially like climate change denials, people who don't even believe that there is climate change despite scientific evidence. So the paradox is that we already been, so geoengineering is an intentional technological modification of the climate. So we were changing it technologically, but unintentionally. And now the idea is to use technology to repair the damage. So the problem, the promise of geoengineering is that we will repair what we have done unintentionally by using technology to promote global cooling, so to stop global warming by technological means, basically. So the geoengineering has like two major possibilities. One is the solar radiation management, which is to let less sun come to Earth. Another is a carbon sequestration, which is like carbon reduction or absorption of carbon dioxide, which we too much pushed into the air. The talks about geoengineering appeared in the course of the 20th century, started in the 20th century and then later in the 21st century. Example event which has led to global geoengineering was the explosion of a volcano in Philippines, which happened, it's like Mount Pinatubo in Philippines, in 1991. So it was one volcanic eruption, which produced about 1.6 Celsius global cooling, which lasted for 15 months. So one small volcano and 15 months, 0.5 degree Celsius, more than this, cooler. So then scientists like Paul Crutzen, who is author of Anthropocene, who is a Nobel Prize winner, reputed geoscientist, he said that why don't we imitate volcano? Sulfur is bad for our lungs. Sulfur is a part of pollution. But what he suggested is let's inject it in the stratosphere, not in the atmosphere, but very high, where nobody lives, so it won't affect our lungs directly. It will stay longer and it will reflect. So the particles of sulfur will reflect back to the space so that less radiation will reach Earth and we will have cooler climate. So it's like clouds. This is one, this is a solar radiation management. But in fact, there are a number of other. So another way is carbon sequestration. So this is all being discussed. So the solar radiation management has already some history, which is a part of the world which I am also coming from. Well, I'm not from Russia, but it's a neighbor of Ukraine. So in Russian scientists in the 90s, they tried to do a solar sails. Solar sails is a huge giant mirrors. First of all, they used it for the space stations to provide electricity on the space station, like a huge mirrors which collect sun and which transform it into later into electricity. But also what Sirametnikov, which is a Russian scientist engineer, suggested is to make a huge solar sail which would reflect more sun to Siberia. For example, in Siberia, there are areas which has like winter night. Almost entire winter, it's dark, whole day. People got depressed. They don't have enough light. So he suggested we put a giant solar mirrors, sails, which would reflect more light. It can help during the polar night. It can help to get better vegetation, help during the planting in spring. So it may help with the permafrost region where it's very dark and not enough light. The program started successfully, but then with political changes in the 90s, Russia has lost interest in the experimentation, so experiments have stopped. But the point is that the same thing, which is used for diverting more light, can be used also to reflect this light back and to cool it. So this can be done relatively, it's relatively inexpensive. So it can be cost like billions of US dollars, which one national government, single nation can afford to do it. So this is a solar radiation management. The ways are like reflecting giant orbit mirrors. And another way is sulfur injecting in the atmosphere. The problem with sulfur injecting in the atmosphere that it will eventually fall down, in the stratosphere, it will eventually go down and it will to the atmosphere, and going in the atmosphere, it will become pollution. So it will be bad for air quality. So this is a problem with solar mirrors on the orbit. It's good for technological development, of course, for space technology. It has also problem that every flight to the orbit produces carbon dioxide, pollutes atmosphere. So it's a technological thing. So this is a one, this is a solar radiation. Another technology which is being suggested is a carbon sequestration or carbon capture and storage. So carbon capture and storage it's already practiced in Switzerland. There is already a firm enterprise, Climeworks, which started in 2017, which is a Swiss company, which commercially takes carbon, absorb carbon dioxide out of the air, and then it sells as carbon dioxide. For example, greenhouses, they need carbon dioxide. Some technological cycles also need carbon dioxide. So basically we do the job of the trees. You can imagine what's the problem with it. So why should we do the job of the trees? First we cut trees, and then we try to do the job for the trees which cut. Isn't it better to plant trees? Well, the problem with planting trees is that it takes long time. We don't have so much time. We need to stop Even if it now stop carbon dioxide emissions, by according to the research, it will still for several centuries continue the global temperature rise, moderate. So even if it stopped all carbon dioxide emissions, so probably just reducing or stopping carbon dioxide emissions is not enough. There is a need for more than this. So that's where also, so the carbon, there are several technologies. So one is removing carbon dioxide and storing it. The problem with it is where to store it. Some suggest under the sea surface, under the sea ground, under the ground, creating huge reservoirs where people store carbon, which is like in a form of coal, which is a form of kind of charcoal, which is being stored and forever until used as biofuel. So this technology needs lots of space. And it may also, so it's biochar, it's called biochar. It's like a carbon-rich charcoal, which is wood burned and reduced oxygen, which can be stored under the earth. So there are other technologies of geoengineering, like ocean pipes, creating clouds, airspace, which simply sprinkles water, clouds. And you know that as soon as clouds appear in the middle of the sun, temperature immediately becomes cooler. This was already done in Mecca for one of the celebrations. Arabic Emirates created cloud seeding as exception to make more cooler atmosphere for the festivities. So in a hot countries, this is imaginable. You create these clouds and water eventually goes back to earth. So you just recycle. There are other technologies like ocean pipes, like putting a huge pipes, which would bounce water into the air, creating more clouds. So more light will be reflected. So the trouble with these technologies is that I would not actually exclude them, but I would compare them to having somebody having, for example, a fever because of bacterial infection and taking only painkiller or taking only heat lowering drugs. There is nothing wrong with taking heat lowering drugs if you have fever. But the problem is that you have to find out what is the cause and address the cause, which is like if it's a bacterial infection. So the cause is that our energy fuels are actually not sustainable. So using fossil fuels is not sustainable in the long run. So we have to switch to green sources like solar energy, like wind power energy, which are carbon neutral. So reducing carbon dioxide, that's like resolving the root cause. So the problem with geoengineering is not so much engineering itself, but that people who work for fossil fuel industry, oil industry, gas, they say that if we have geoengineering, do we need mitigation? And mitigation is switching to green sources of energy. So the problem is political, not so much as technological. So if geoengineering is used as an additional complementary measure to remove excessive carbon dioxide, this should not be a problem. The problem is that we still need to resolve the root cause, which is removing fossil fuels out of operation and fossil fuel free electricity. Solar energy, for example, it's universal because it can also help also terraforming, because the geoengineering is very close. It's called like a planet engineering. It's called also close to the forming geoengineering other planets. So this was first science fiction topic. Probably somebody of you read about science fiction about geoengineering Mars or Moon. But now it's more or less becoming realistically discussed by Elon Musk, for example, whether the technologies which are used for geoengineering climate on the Earth, they can also be applied for terraforming other planets and thus ensuring the long-term survival of humankind. Because, well, if we live all on one planet, it's a bit risky. whatever can happen to this planet if humanity has spread all over the cosmos, solar system, this can make it more sustainable. So the in fact, geoengineering, the same, some of these technologies which are used to cool climate on the Earth, they can also, in principle, the scale be applied to make other solar system planets habitable. So this is the essence of terraforming, and they are considered connected. So the questions, I wanted to ask you some of the questions, like, what do you think about actually, like, do you think that uncertainty, so do you think we should dare to meddle with Earth's climate in such fundamental and unprecedented way, like geoengineering? Have you thought of this?
So Professor, about that, so I had another question. So in the Rio Declaration, they introduced the precautionary principle, right? So that allowed decision makers to take those decisions if there is a deficit with respect to scientific evidence. So about geoengineering, I do feel like it is an option that should be explored in the future, and I'll come up with another point after that. But it is something that we must explore, because that's giving scientists time to come up with innovative solutions. And speaking of innovative solutions, just last year, there was an experiment in Australia that was trying to cool down the Great Barrier Reef. This was done by spraying nano-sized crystal particles, salt particles, into clouds, which could help cooling and reflect more sunlight. So about this experiment that happened in Australia, what adverse effects could be noticed or could happen if they decide to continue with this experiment?
Okay, nano-sized salt crystals. Yeah, this is a kind of cloud seeding. Cloud seeding, if the clouds consist out of water, that's relatively, actually the carbon sequestration, consider it relatively innocent or not so risky, less risky, because we undo the damage what we have already done. So it's not so innovative. We were pushing too much carbon dioxide, so now we are pulling it out. So this sounds like an indeed interesting idea, because it's also temporary. So once you made clouds, you can make them, they will last maybe a day or a few days, then you would need to do it again. So it is easy to redo. If you don't need it anymore, we can stop doing it. That's one of the things with geoengineering, that risks of geoengineering considered, like James Lovelock says, that once we start, we may be bound for it, because we maybe need to continue in order, so we will become kind of responsible for regulating Earth's climate, which until now was self-regulating, but now the humanity will need to constantly put efforts, put budget and work into having a stable climate. And also political issues, because we have like 200 plus nations on this planet, and even a single nation in principle can change climate on the Earth by injecting lots of sulfur in the stratosphere. This is feasible. So what if others disagree? What if this can be, or do we able to reach agreement on something which would benefit everybody and don't damage nobody? So this can be also issue of political, the need for reaching political agreement is quite high for this, and the need for reaching consensus. Even in Paris 2015, there was difficult to reach consensus about how to reduce carbon dioxide emissions to keep climate under 1.52 degrees Celsius. So this is what I think about this political problems. So it's a risky territory. You know that there are conflicts about water use, so if about climate, like Africa wants more cooling, Norway wants less cooling, maybe.
Okay, so just to follow up, if you go down the route of geoengineering, are you catalyzing the Earth regeneration process, or are you moving Earth down a different route? Because something that we've seen during the pandemic is that a lot of places on Earth are regenerating itself by itself. They're going back to their previous former conditions, or they're going to healthier conditions. So with geoengineering, are we speeding up the process at which Earth regenerates, or are we moving it in a different path?
Yeah, it's a good question. It can be both. I think it depends on what exactly you do. With solar radiation management, you're moving to a different path. With carbon sequestration, I think it's helping regenerating because it's restoring the normal amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. There is also option of iron seeding the ocean, which is introducing small particles of iron to feed phytoplankton in the ocean. And this is also different path because this can, like the problem also geoengineering, it can help save biodiversity above the water, so on the earth, but it doesn't help acidification of the ocean. And acidification of the ocean is bad for fish, for marine animals and marine plants. This seeding ocean with phytoplankton. Phytoplankton are small plants which grow on the surface and which produce enormous amount of oxygen and which absorb carbon dioxide a lot. So they may do the job, but this may also come at expense of the fish, and fisheries also who live from fishing. So this may have bad impacts on marine life. So I feel like it's, but I agree that indeed keeping it as a last option, keeping it as a security option in case we gone too far. So to escape runaway climate change, runaway global warming, to stop it, that may be actually a good idea, in fact. And one of my hopes also is that techniques which are useful for geoengineering on Earth can be also applied for space geoengineering, for terraforming planets and expanding human civilization beyond this planet as well. And do you think that if humans, another question also connected to geoengineering, like, is the uncertainty of human future on this planet require or stimulate us to terraform other planets? You probably heard of Elon Musk Mars mission, sending spaceship and trying to create atmosphere on Mars, to create, for example, making a greenhouse effect on Mars by putting more carbon dioxide in the Martian atmosphere, increasing pressure on it, so making Mars more like Earth. So that it was habitable by humans. Are there science fiction fans here?
I'm afraid not, Professor. It'll be really insightful if you could, like, you know, brief us about this aspect. Because honestly, making like the Mars atmosphere more habitable through these techniques is something even worth hearing for the first time. So if you could like elaborate, because that's actually really intriguing.
Okay. Yeah, sounds great. So, and just an imaginable scenario, if you come on Mars and if humans land on Mars and somehow will be latterly threatened by Martians or by Martian bacteria, do you think should humans attack the Martians? Well, there is no intelligent life on Mars, we know, but we don't know if there is really no life on Mars at all. Some human bacteria survive on Mars, minus 50 Celsius, very cold, but some terrestrial bacteria still survive even in this cold. So we cannot exclude possibility of some bacteria, some very microbial primitive life present on Mars. So how would you choose this scenario?
I was going to say that shouldn't we aim to kind of fix our planet or save our planet first without going to others and ruining those? Because while Elon Musk may say that, you know, nuking the poles of Mars could help create that atmosphere, I don't think too much thought has gone into it with respect to the impacts that could happen afterwards. There's no simulations we could run. There's no models to see what could happen afterwards. So I personally think we should look at saving our planet first, because we haven't reached the tipping point. It's still possible. We're reaching it. We're getting close to it, but it can still be done.
Absolutely.
Right. In addition to that, Professor, I feel that Ours is a planet which has developed life over like millions of years and has just the right conditions, which are found in very, very few places in the universe, for life to grow and then sustain and then flourish into, from like single-celled organisms to multicellular organisms that can think for themselves and are conscious, right? And so I just don't understand the point of going to what is, excuse the expression, but basically a shithole planet with no oxygen. And I think Himmat is right. We should instead focus the little or however funds that we have and resources into saving the planet that we have, right? I mean, don't you think so?
Absolutely. I agree. Our priority is saving and restoring the flourishment of life on Earth. That's the current priority should be, absolutely, and directing all resources into this. It's a bit a different question. It's more like cultural, historical, philosophical question. If you look at our legends, at our dreams, at our myth, people always dreamt about flying. And to some extent, I think humanity becoming a force, it became already a geological force on Earth. Humanity reaching its full potential would require us to expand beyond Earth's limits. But indeed, first saving our home, then exploring the larger cosmos. Absolutely. So, yeah.
Mom, I think what's going to happen eventually is if we encounter some form of life on Mars, is not very different from what happened when the colonial powers went and colonized different parts of the world in the global south. So I don't see the interaction being very different from that, because then you are meeting this completely alien civilization or alien form of life. And at that point of time, it mostly becomes about who gets to be the conqueror first and and just who establishes the first rights of ownership and property and things like that. So I believe the scenario to be to then become something of a similar sort when the Dutch East India Company or the East India Company first started expanding their projects. Yeah,
indeed. It is also an interesting legal issue. There was international agreement of not making Moon anyone's, any private territory, that Moon is a common heritage of humanity and no particular country or company should claim. But it's difficult to exclude the possibility of companies or countries claiming their right, because every planet is also resources. It's also economic resources, I heard there is a gold on Mars, but I may be mistaken. But anyway, some resources can be found on other planets, minerals. So how to resolve this issue in a peaceful way, in a constructive way, and prevent conflicts, because every new exploration can result into. Also, there was a military use of some geoengineering techniques by US in Vietnam War, when they prolonged monsoon, the data leaked from the FBI that they prolonged monsoon intentionally to help American army. So the risk is also that the same geoengineering technology can also be used for power claims, for power conflicts, for power dominance and so on. And this is already a risk, maybe, what is China doing with Brahmaputra and with some other rivers. So putting dams and directing the flow of the rivers, some of which flow also to India. So that's a risk of geoengineering, which benefits one region at the expense of another region. So it's a quite issue which has a legal issues and legal implications as well.
We've looked at like the historical trajectory of geoengineering. We've seen the fundamental technologies used in it, etc. So the one thing which constantly keeps coming up in this discourse is this like a sustainable option, right? Or are there alternatives would stand in the present world, which could actually tackle climate change head on in a more efficient manner, or maybe a more sustainable manner than geoengineering. Is there an option like that? Or is geoengineering the one we're trying to, you know, push forward and, you know, use it as the only option?
Thank you, Aishi. Indeed, no, the major, like the primary option is a mitigation. So by mitigation, it's kind of prevention. So it's better to, you know, prevent problem than to resolve it later. So the idea of mitigation is to simply move towards a carbon dioxide free technology, move towards energy system which would not produce any carbon dioxide, which is, for example, wind power or solar power, with some exceptions like solar power still made of plastic, and producing this plastic still produces some small CO2. But this is resolvable issue. In principle, we can replace maybe plastic with some other stuff in the solar power. But in principle, it's much less. So the radical sustainable solution is moving towards green energy. Green energy are the best ones which we use is which we know is a wind and solar, because hydropower is also like it damages river life, it occupies space which is usually covered by forests and other species, so it has some damage. But these two technologies, they are the best, and they will hopefully make revolution by making energy cheap, available, abundant, because solar energy is abundant everywhere on Earth and outside. So this is the solution which I see, and geoengineering is something which may help as additional, as like preventing runaway warming, as preventing overheat as a temporary measure. But it's not something which can in the, I would not want us to rely on these artificial measures in the long run, because we need simply to make carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere optimal and keep it optimal sustainably. So this is the, I see as a mainstream, and this is kind of additional measure which may be useful in some cases.
Professor, so we were talking about how these different countries, China, US, and the things that US and Vietnam, the kind of geoengineering tactics they adopted. But the thing with geoengineering again is that our climate is globally connected, and thus the implications of geoengineering, as you mentioned, they're widespread. So if these implications are widespread, what are the geopolitical implications of using such geoengineering techniques?
Yeah, thanks, Nanki. This is, I cannot say what is one geopolitical implication, but this may be compared to even like weapons, though, because geoengineering, unfortunately, which is very sad, but it can be used as a weapon, as a new type of weapon, and this is sad and risky. So it can be used by one country against another one to threaten, to dominate, or to control. So until now, it's not used this way, but it's a potential for conflict, and it's potential for international conflict, unfortunately. This is something which would be very nice to do some steps to prevent it. Until now, there is no one country which would sustainably like use geoengineering in this way. Fortunately, not US doing it in Vietnam War. This was a single case. This was not like doing regularly. But yeah, this is something for lawyers to think about, for international lawyers, how to avoid the militarization of geoengineering, and how to prevent it becoming a global conflict source. So this is a risky area. But I cannot say one country, well, maybe China, what is doing with its rivers, this huge rivers project. In Soviet Union in the 70s, there was a plan to change the flow of rivers, but Russian scientists protested. They wrote a letter with a protest to the government, and fortunately, government listened to the voice of reason and abandoned this very risky projects.
Right. Thank you so much, Professor. Sure.
So, according to you, and it's like a very well-established fact that there is a disparity between the resources among the countries, right? I mean, for some countries, it's feasible to avail these techniques of geoengineering, but for other countries, it's not. So in your opinion, how does geoengineering affect the global resource imbalance?
How it, the global resource impact or distribution?
The distribution and the impact both.
Distribution of global resources, yeah. Look, I wanted to introduce this topic because I think it's important and it's controversial. But I don't want to deny that geoengineering is a controversial topic, especially because, unfortunately, in US, if you look, the divide is that mostly environmentalists are critical of it, and mostly it's the oil and fossil fuel lobby, which are actually supportive of it. The thing is that already now we see that climate change, which is difficult to stop, we can only like diminish it, mitigate it, but really stop difficult. It will affect Earth in a not the same way, not equal way. So there is a potential for disparity. It may affect South more. Also North will also have problems with it. So like Florida, like California will have problems. Europe may have problems with sea level rise, so the whole European continent may be flooded. So this, small island nations, especially small island nations and the coastal people who live on the coast in hot areas, desert areas, can be affected unequally. So there is a huge potential for unequal, and there is a risk that actually developing countries would be more affected by it also because of the lack of resources. For example, sea level rise is not unsolvable problem. For example, Netherlands, country where I spent more than 20 years and I'm citizen of it, has always struggled with water. Water was like a friend and a foe at the same time. So Netherlands is large part of Netherlands is below the sea level. So they built dams, they built fortifications, a specialist, Dutch specialist in building this fortification. So even if sea level rise, if you have enough technological resources, you can simply build protective walls and this would be fine, but you need to do it in time and with the right technology. So the resource poor countries can be impoverished even more. So this can lead to increasing inequality in the world. So we need even more, we need international cooperation, we need solidarity, we need technology transfer. And in fact, I think what's necessary is a humanity kind of coordinated response, like what we saw during pandemics, when the World Health Organization recommendations were implemented voluntarily by most countries simultaneously in a coordinated manner, because everybody understood that it's a matter of life. It's important, so everybody done it. So if there was a possible, this kind of cooperation, that's what required, because it may indeed, climate change may indeed affect South in a disproportionate way, which must be prevented.
So Professor, I want to stay on the disparity topic and link this back to the science fiction, because I'm a big fan of that genre. So something that might be explored is harvesting the moon for helium-3. So helium-3 is an isotope that could be used for nuclear energy. It could power our planet for maybe hundreds of decades or hundreds of years. So there are those countries that can go to space. There's the US, there's Russia, there's China, and then there are those that can't. So, and something that we can see is that this disparity is growing. So let's say a country were to go to the moon and harvest helium-3, bring it back and power only their own country with nuclear energy, and they don't help others that are kind of struggling with any form of energy. What kind of geopolitical implications or adverse impacts could that have on the policies or political aspects of world conflict?
Yeah, this is another source of risk. And I think it should be actually addressed by organizations like UN, by preventative, by making agreements about sharing resources. I think until now, by international law, moon belongs to humanity, and no particular country or company can claim moon its own. So the same is, if moon is a common property of humanity, then it's not fair if some country gets its resources, which is able to go to space, so, and uses it only for its own profitability. It should be sharing of resources, and it should be more equitable way. But then the question is indeed like, well, yeah, I can understand that maybe indeed, I'm not sure whether nuclear energy, well, there are new forms of nuclear energy. There is like a cold fusion, and there are ways which are less risky than current. So there is some promise, there is some hope for the nuclear energy, different types of fusion, not like the one which is used traditionally, which is too risky and which produces this radioactive waste, which you have to deal with. So I wonder, like, if nuclear energy is the potentially good source for future energy at all.
Yes. So, okay. So we'll come back to the Earth side and not outer space. So recently there were a few people have started noticing that the Russian military is trying to take control of the Arctic. This is something that the world had initially agreed that it's one of the commons. So nobody has control over it. Nobody owns it, but Russia has started to, you know, expand its military or expand its stage. So one of the things that they've been doing in the Arctic is they've started drilling two wells for oil. What power, and this also gives them power over, or gives them more space over some of the surrounding countries. So just two questions. What kind of power does that give them with respect to using oil, and how quickly they can use oil to develop? And what sort of political implications does that have on the rest of the world?
Well, as you know, Russia is an authoritarian country, so it's not a democratic regime, and many actually Russian oppositions. You probably heard what happened recently to Navalny, who was arrested by KGB and who was attempted to being poisoned by KGB and now in prison. So there are a lot of opposition to this regime, but current Russian regime is not democratic. Not transparent, it's claiming power for itself, so many Russians disagree with it. Actually, data which I had, majority of young Russians don't like regime and would like to change it for democracy. It's a sad fact, which I just don't think that exploring oil is something which will last long. Because as our Dean of Sustainability School, Professor Armin Rosenkrantz wrote, that king oil is dying soon. So today, using oil, using coal, it was about taking coal, but it becomes less and less rentable. And the faster we switch to solar energy, the better will be for the country, because strategically, well, using fossil fuels loses its rentability, profitability simply. It's a thing of the past. I hope Russian government will also understand it.
So, Professor, that's been extremely insightful. And I think now we can see that we've had a really good understanding about how all these things work, and especially the politics. I think that aspect is something which stands out. So no matter how clear and, you know, logical science may sound, especially on the geoengineering aspect, the minute it comes in connection with politics and other socioeconomic, cultural factors, I think it makes a big difference. And The fact that you did highlight that international collaboration is something which is absolutely essential in making geoengineering more cohesive for the world as a whole is something that must be highlighted as well. So I was just asking, on a more conclusive note, if we could get where geoengineering stands today and its impact on climate mitigation and where it's going to go in the future. Just a few words on that.
So geoengineering is a extreme technological efficient way to cool the planet, which is not sustainable, which is risky, and probably will have many negative consequences also for life on Earth. So it's a risky way, it's an extreme way. I think it might be regarded as a last resort in case situation goes out of control, but it's not a mainstream way. The mainstream way is a technological revolution in energy production and switching towards sustainable energy, climate neutral energy production, and developing climate neutral industries. So this is a switch which would bring a really technological huge innovation and change, making us abundant on cheap and green, clean energy. So this is a mainstream way, but geoengineering it's a risky thing. It's risky because of ecological consequences, because of geopolitical, because it may be used as a weapon and it may be used as an instrument in a power competition between countries. But it's interesting thing that it may be also help us to develop technologies which we would need in future for the cosmic expansion of humanity, which may be very important for the long-term future of humankind. So this is maybe the positive part of it, that it is developing technology which can later be applied on Mars, on Moon, on Venus, and other parts of space.
Thank you so much, Professor. This was a very, very insightful and enlightening conversation. And we're so grateful to have you here and for taking out the time to have this conversation and teach us and about geoengineering, which was a topic I think most of us were unaware of. And so we have learned a lot through this conversation. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners will also learn quite a bit. So thank you so much. For being here.
Thank you, everybody. It's a great pleasure to meet you. And thank you for inviting me for this conversation.